This deep diet is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at CertFuel.com.
Absolutely. It's a lifesaver for this stuff.
Yeah, really is. Okay, so imagine logging into your brokerage account on a random Tuesday morning. You've executed what you thought was a completely safe conservative trade. You step away for literally 5 minutes to get a coffee.
Right.
And when you come back, your screen is just flashing red. Your entire portfolio has been liquidated without your permission, and you somehow owe the brokerage firm like $50,000 that you absolutely do not have.
And the craziest part is there is legally no ceiling to how much money you could lose in that moment.
Exactly. Welcome to the deep dive. Because if you are listening to this, you are likely staring down the barrel of the Series 65 exam, and you need to understand exactly how a nightmare scenario like that is completely 100% legal under federal securities laws. It's a terrifying scenario, honestly. But it happens every single day to retail investors who just do not understand the plumbing of the financial markets.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what we are dissecting today.
Right. And we have a very specific mission for this one. We are not just going to read you a dry textbook. If you're anything like me, your eyes glaze over after about 2 minutes of that.
Oh, totally. Mine too.
So we've pulled together a massive stack of sources, the actual FINRA rulebooks, some really intense historical SEC enforcement actions, and the absolute most heavily tested concepts from the Series 65 prep materials.
We are going to wire this information into your brain.
Yes, so deeply that when you finally sit down for that exam, the answers just appear. You won't even have to think about it.
Because we're talking about the trading securities and market participants section of the exam.
Right.
Now, in terms of sheer volume, this material only accounts for roughly 4 questions, or about 3% of the total exam.
Which, I mean, that sounds incredibly small, right? Like, why are we spending an hour on 3%? Yeah, but do not let that percentage fool you. I cannot stress that enough. This material is the foundation of the entire financial system.
Yeah, it's the bedrock.
Right. If you do not understand the absolute baseline mechanics of how a trade actually happens, the later, more complex questions on the exam.
Like portfolio management.
Exactly. Portfolio management, fiduciary duty, systemic risk. Mm-hmm. All of that is going to feel like it's written in a foreign language. You have to understand the concrete mechanics of the arena before you can advise a client on how to play the game.
Spot on. So to make this stick, and frankly, to keep us all highly entertained, because we all have ADHD here, we are going to use a recurring cast of characters today. We're going to use them to demonstrate these concepts.
Bringing dry regulations to life.
Exactly. We're doing scenarios you will not forget. So First up, we have Fumbling Fred.
Oh, Fred.
Yeah. Fred is a well-meaning, overly enthusiastic, but entirely chaotic retail investor. He's the guy who watches like one single YouTube video on day trading and instantly thinks he's a Wall Street wizard.
And then he constantly stumbles into every single regulatory and financial trap ever invented.
Right. It's almost impressive how bad he is at this.
It's a classic archetype, though. I mean, ask any veteran financial advisor, and they will tell you they have at least one fumbling Fred in their book of business.
Oh, without a doubt. So next we have Broker Betty. She is the patient, rule-abiding intermediary. She handles Fred's accounts, fields his frantic phone calls, and basically just tries to keep him from completely destroying his net worth on a daily basis.
Oh, bless her heart.
Seriously. And finally, we have Market Maker Mike. He is the institutional heavyweight. He's the guy in the expensive suit sitting behind a literal wall of monitors who actually holds the inventory of stocks and makes the trades happen behind the scenes.
Grounding these abstract rules in reality with these characters is critical for retention. Mm. Now, before we jump into Fred's first total disaster, let me just break the fourth wall for a second.
Go for it.
I want to give you, the listener, a roadmap for how we are going to approach this material, especially if your brain tends to wander during standard lectures.
Which happens to the best of us.
Right. Passive listening simply does not work for deep retention. You can't just have this playing in the background while you do the dishes and expect to pass. So we are going to use Fred's training disasters to learn the rules, but we are also going to ask you direct questions throughout this deep dive.
Yes, this is key. When we ask you a question, do not just let the audio wash over you. I want you to actively pause, think about it, and lock in an answer in your head before we reveal it.
Right. Force yourself to answer.
Because it's that tiny moment of cognitive struggle, that friction, that actually builds the memory pathway in your brain.
Precisely. The goal here is deep retention and exam strategy. We're going to focus heavily on the why and the how behind these rules.
Not just a rote memorization.
Exactly. Because if you understand the underlying mechanism, like why a rule was created in the first place, you can logic your way through a tricky, unfamiliar exam question, even if you forget the exact textbook definition.
That makes total sense. Okay, yeah, let's set the stage with the arena and the players. Before Fumbling Fred can make a terrible trade, we need to understand the ecosystem he is stepping into. Like, who actually does what?
Right, let's look at Broker Betty.
Okay, so Betty is what the industry calls an introducing broker-dealer. She has the relationship with Fred. She takes his calls. She accepts his orders, maybe gives him some investment advice.
She provides the slick smartphone app he uses to look at his portfolio.
Right. But here is where the illusion completely breaks. Betty does not actually hold any of Fred's money or his stock certificates.
She doesn't hold a dime. And to understand why, you really have to look at the immense regulatory burden and the sheer financial risk of custody.
It's a nightmare for a small firm.
Total nightmare. If Betty's firm actually held the asset, they would be subjected to grueling compliance audits, massive capital requirements from the SEC, and the need for literal and digital vaults.
Yeah, think about the cybersecurity infrastructure required to safeguard billions of dollars in client assets from, like, international hackers.
Exactly.
Betty's firm might just be a boutique operation. They just want to focus purely on sales, research, and client relationships.
Right.
They absolutely do not want the headache, the liability, or the massive expense of custody.
I always like to think of this in terms of tech. Broker Betty is just the front-end user interface. Mm-hmm. She is the sleek app on your phone. But she routes everything to a clearing broker-dealer, which is also known as a custodian.
The back end.
Yes. The clearing firm is the AWS cloud servers running in the background. They are the giant, heavily fortified digital vault. They were the ones who actually process the complex plumbing of the trade, clear it through the central depositories, and settle it.
They hold the custody of the assets.
Right. They are the ones mailing out the trade confirmations in the official account statements, not Betty.
That is a perfect analogy. And this actually brings us to our first direct question for you, the listener. Let's say Fumbling Fred falls for a terrible phishing scam.
Typical Fred. Right. He gets an email, clicks a bad link, and his account gets totally hacked. The hackers attempt to drain his portfolio. Here is the question. Who was actually holding his assets in their digital vault? Was it Broker Betty, the introducing broker, or was it the clearing firm?
Okay, listener, take a second. Pause the audio if you have to. Answer it in your head right now.
Okay, it's the clearing firm.
Exactly. It's always the clearing firm. And listener, this is a massive exam trap alert. The exam loves, and I mean loves, to test the distinction between introducing and clearing firms.
Oh, they do. They try to trick you constantly.
They will present this long paragraph scenario that subtly implies an introducing broker-dealer is safeguarding customer funds, or maybe they are temporarily holding a client's check in a drawer somewhere. That is always false.
Yep.
Never happens.
Introducing broker-dealers never hold customer funds or securities.
Mm-hmm.
Only clearing or custodial broker-dealers do. If an exam question mentions custody, holding assets, or maintaining the ultimate physical or digital control, you are looking for the clearing firm, period. Good rule of thumb. Okay, now let's add Market Maker Mike to the board. We have Betty taking Fred's order. We have the clearing firm in the background ready to handle the settlement and move the digital money.
Right.
But where does the actual stock come from when Fred mashes the buy button on his phone?
Yeah. Who is on the other side of that?
Enter the market maker. Mike's entire job is to stand ready to buy and sell a particular security on a continuous basis using his own inventory at publicly quoted prices.
Wait. Okay. I need to logic this out for a second. Because why do we even need Mike? I mean, we have massive centralized exchanges, right? Like the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ.
Sure do.
So if Fumbling Fred wants to buy 100 shares of Apple, why can't he just buy them directly from, you know, another retail investor somewhere in Ohio who happens to want to sell 100 shares of Apple at that exact millisecond on the exchange? Why insert this expensive guy in a suit in the middle?
That is the fundamental question of market structure. And honestly, in a perfect world for a massively traded stock like Apple, you might actually be able to naturally match buyers and sellers.
Because there's so much volume.
Right. Exchanges are centralized marketplaces designed exactly to provide price transparency and match those natural counterparties. But here is the systemic problem. What happens if Fumbling Fred wants to buy 100 shares of some obscure thinly traded small cap stock.
Oh, right. Like his favorite Hypergalactic crypto mining core.
Yes, exactly. Hypergalactic crypto. What if he wants to buy that at 2.14 p.m. on a random Tuesday? And absolutely no one in the world wants to sell that specific garbage stock at that exact moment.
If there's no mic, then Fred's order just sits there. The transaction fails.
Exactly. The market freezes up. And a frozen market is a broken, untrustworthy market. If investors think they can't get their money in or out exactly when they want to, they will simply stop investing altogether.
It ruins confidence in the whole system.
Completely. That is why Market Maker Mike exists. He provides liquidity. He trades as a principal, using his own personal inventory. Think of it as Mike literally carrying around a massive backpack full of stock certificates and cash.
I love that visual. Just a guy in a suit with a huge JanSport backpack.
Basically, yeah. And he is literally required by the exchange to maintain a two-sided quote.
Okay, let's unpack that term. A two-sided quote. That means Mike has to publicly state at all times, during all normal market hours, the exact price at which he's willing to buy the stock and the exact price at which he is willing to sell the stock.
Yes, both sides. And here is the real kicker. Even if the market is absolutely crashing, even if terrible news just broke and absolutely no one else in the world wants to touch the stock, Mike has to stand there and take the other side of the trade to keep the market orderly.
Wow.
He ensures that when Fred hits buy, the trade actually executes instantly. Even if Mike has to sell Fred the shares directly out of his own backpack when he really doesn't want to, he is the ultimate shock absorber for the financial system.
Which naturally leads us to ask, how does everyone get paid? Because Market Maker Mike is taking on massive risk by being that shock absorber, and he is certainly not running a charity.
Definitely not.
And neither is Broker Betty. Understanding compensation is honestly the skeleton key to understanding firm capacity on the Series 65 exam.
It really is. If you can master the concept of capacity, you will easily secure several points on this test. Listen to this closely. A firm can wear one of two hats on any given trade. They can act as an agency, or they can act as a principal.
Right.
And the compensation dictates the hat.
Okay, let's lay these side by side because they are super easy to confuse when you're reading fast. Let's start with the agency capacity. This is when the firm acts as a broker.
Right.
In our ongoing story, this is Broker Betty. When Betty acts as an agent, she is essentially just a matchmaker. She looks at Fred's order to buy and she goes out into the broader market to find a seller.
Right. She doesn't use her own stock.
Exactly. She takes zero inventory risk. She just connects the two parties, like Tinder for stocks. And for performing this safe matchmaking service, her compensation is called a commission.
Spot on. Now, compare that directly to the principal capacity. This is when the firm acts as a dealer. This is a market maker, Mike.
A guy with a backpack.
Yes.
Yeah.
When Mike acts as a principal, he is not matchmaking at all. He is a dealer transacting directly out of his own inventory. If Fred wants to buy, Mike sells him shares from his own backpack. If Fred wants to sell, Mike buys them and puts them into his backpack.
He's taking on the risk of holding that asset.
Yes. And because he takes on risk, he doesn't charge a commission. His compensation is a markup if he is selling the stock out of his backpack to Fred, or a markdown if he is buying the stock from Fred to put into his backpack.
Okay, listener, pay very close attention to this next part. I'm hitting the exam trap alert button again.
It's a big one.
The exam will describe a long, convoluted paragraph about a specific trade scenario. They'll throw in lots of distracting numbers, talk about the time of day, all this fluff, and then ask you what capacity the firm was acting in.
Don't fall for it.
Right. Do not get lost in the weeds of the story. Scan the text exclusively for the compensation method. If you see the word commission, the firm acted as an agent. If you see the words markup, markdown, or inventory, the firm acted as a principal.
Simple as that.
Commission equals agent. Markup equals principal. I would literally write that on my scratch paper the second I sat down for the exam.
It's a lifesaver.
And there is a golden rule here, right? A firm cannot act as both a principal and an agent on the exact same trade without special written disclosure and consent from the customer. You cannot be the matchmaker charging a commission and the dealer charging a markup simultaneously.
No, because it is a massive conflict of interest. Think about the underlying incentives here. If you are the dealer selling from your own inventory, you naturally want to sell at the highest possible price to maximize your profit. But if you are also acting as the client's agent, your fiduciary duty is to get them the lowest possible price. You cannot mathematically serve two masters on the same transaction.
It's impossible. So let's throw Fumbling Fred into a scenario to test this. Let's say Fred decides to buy that truly terrible, highly illiquid penny stock we mentioned, Hypergalactic Crypto Mining Corp.
Lovely.
He places the order, the trade executes, and he looks at his confirmation statement. He sees that market maker Mike acted as principal and charged him a 6% markup.
Fuck.
Fred absolutely loses his mind. He threatens to call Finn around. He's screaming on the phone to Betty about the FINRA 5% policy that he just read about on Reddit. What is going on here? Is Mike going to jail for charging 6%?
No, Mike is not going to jail. And Fred is completely misunderstanding the rule, which is a very common trap for students studying for this exam. FINRA does indeed have a 5% markup policy, but the critical, heavily tested word there is policy or guideline.
Yeah.
It is not an absolute ironclad legal cap.
So Mike can just charge whatever he wants, like 50%?
No, definitely not whatever he wants. The overarching rule states that markups must be fair and reasonable based on all relevant facts and circumstances of that specific trade.
Fair and reasonable. Got it.
So let's look at the actual mechanics. If Fred is buying a highly illiquid, bizarre penny stock, Mike is taking on an enormous amount of risk to source that stock and hold it in his inventory just in case Fred wants it. The stock might literally go to zero while Mike is holding it.
Yeah, it's garbage.
Because of that extreme risk, a 6% markup might actually be deemed perfectly fair and reasonable by FINRA regulators.
But let me flip it then. What if Fred was buying 100 shares of Microsoft? Highly liquid, easily traded, virtually zero risk for Mike to hold in his backpack. If Mike charged a 4% markup on Microsoft, that's technically under the 5% guideline. So is he safe?
Almost certainly not. On a highly liquid security like Microsoft, a 4% markup would likely be considered a massive violation in price gouging, even though it sits below the 5% threshold.
What?
The 5% rule is a baseline. It's a starting point for the conversation. Markups above 5% are not automatically violations, and markups below 5% are not automatically reasonable. The exam absolutely loves to test your understanding of this nuance.
Okay, I have a tricky hypothetical for you to push back on this whole capacity thing. Let's say Betty gets Fred's order to buy 100 shares of Apple, but Betty's firm doesn't have any Apple shares in their inventory.
Okay.
So Betty's firm goes out to the market, buys 100 shares of Apple with their own money, puts them in their inventory for exactly 1 millisecond, and then immediately resells them to Fred from their inventory to fill his order.
Right.
They took absolutely zero risk. They literally had the buyer lined up before they bought the stock. Is that an agency trade because they just went out and matched it, or is it a principal trade?
That is what the industry calls a riskless principal trade. And honestly, the legal name gives away the answer. Even though Betty's firm took virtually zero market risk, the actual mechanics of the trade dictate the capacity.
Because it hit their account.
Exactly. They bought the stock for their own account, and they sold it from their own account. Therefore, under the law, it is still a principal trade.
And listener, here is your direct question based on what we just learned. Because it is a principal trade, what kind of compensation applies? Pause and think about it for a second.
It has to be a markup. Even in a riskless principal transaction, the compensation is a markup, not a commission.
That is exactly how the exam writers tried to trick you. They will emphasize how riskless it was, how fast it was, all to make you think it's just a matchmaking agency trade. Don't fall for it.
It's all about whose account it passed through.
Right. Okay, let's pivot to the mechanics of the quote itself. We know market maker Mike charges a markup when he acts as principal, but what is the actual base price he is working from? To understand that, we have to look at the quote, which consists of the bid and the ask.
This is where a lot of people get tangled up, because it depends entirely on whose perspective you're looking from.
Yeah, it hurts my brain sometimes.
The absolute easiest way to understand this is to get away from Wall Street and use a real-world analogy.
Yes. Okay, listener, I want you to picture an airport currency exchange booth. You are traveling overseas and you need euros. The booth is the market maker. What does that booth want to do?
They want to make money off you.
Right. They want to buy your US dollars as cheaply as possible, and they want to sell you euros for as much money as possible. They want to buy low and sell high. That is the fundamental rule of commerce.
Exactly. So let's apply that exact logic to the quote. The bid is the price the dealer, the booth, is willing to pay to buy the asset from you. It is always the lower price.
Makes sense.
The ask, also known as the offer, is the price the dealer is demanding to sell the asset to you. It is always the higher price.
The quote on your screen always, always represents the market maker's perspective, not yours. Here's a direct question for you, listener. Fumbling Fred logs into his account. He wants to BUY one share of a stock. The quote on the screen says, bid, $50. Ask, $50.20.
Classic quote.
Which price does Fred pay? Does he pay the lower $50 bid or the higher $50.20 ask? Pause and lock in your answer.
Right. Fred pays the higher ask price of $50.20.
Right. Fred is the retail customer. He always gets the worst end of the deal compared to the dealer. Investors buy at the ask the higher price, and they sell at the bid the lower price.
And the dealer does the exact opposite. The dealer buys at the bid and sells at the ask.
And that difference between the two prices, that 20 cents in your example.
That is the bid-ask spread. That spread is Mike's profit margin. It is his compensation for making the market and taking on the risk of holding that inventory.
And here is where it gets incredibly real for the investor and why you really need to understand this for the exam. The spread is an implicit transaction cost.
Huge point.
It is not a separate fee listed on the confirmation statement like a commission, but it drains your account just the same. Let's walk through it. Fred buys that stock at the ask price of $50.20.
Right.
1 second later, he reads a scary headline online, completely panics, and decides to sell it. He hasn't paid a commission. The market hasn't moved a single millimeter in that 1 second. He hits sell. What price does he get?
He is forced to sell at the dealer's bid price, which is $50.
Exactly. So he bought it for $50.20, immediately sold it for $50, and lost 20 cents per share. He lost money without the underlying market moving at all.
That is the brutal implicit cost of the spread.
And this ties directly back to our earlier point about liquidity and risk. If you were trading a massive, highly liquid stock like an S&P 500 ETF, the spread might be a single penny.
Yeah, super tight.
The implicit cost is tiny because the market maker takes almost no risk. But if Fumbling Fred is trading his obscure hypergalactic crypto penny stock?
The dealer is taking on massive risk by holding that junk. So the dealer widens the spread to protect themselves. The quote might be bid $1 ask. $1.50.
That is a 50 cent spread on a dollar stock. You automatically lose 50% of your investment the second you click buy, just from the spread alone.
Precisely. So the core concept to remember is narrow spread equals highly liquid security. Wide spread equals illiquid security. The exam will definitely test your understanding of how market liquidity dynamically impacts the width of the bid-ask spread.
Okay, let's take a mental breath. Pattern interrupt. Roll your shoulders, stretch your neck, grab a sip of water.
Hydrate.
We are moving into the order playbook. Fred knows the prices now. He understands the spread. How does he actually submit the instructions to Broker Betty? What are the order types? Let's start with the classic trade-off. Market orders versus limit orders.
This is the eternal battle of speed versus price. It is a fundamental structural trade-off. You can guarantee execution or you can guarantee price, but you generally cannot guarantee both simultaneously.
Let's look at a market order. Fumbling Fred sees a stock moving fast. He mashes the button on his app and essentially screams into the digital void, buy it now, W. I don't care what it costs. Just get me the shares immediately.
That is a market order. It guarantees execution. Fred will absolutely, positively get the shares.
But it offers absolutely zero guarantee on the price.
None. He will pay whatever the prevailing ask price is at the exact millisecond his order hits market maker Mike's server.
And in a normal, calm market, that is totally fine. But in a fast-moving or volatile market, it is so dangerous. Fred might see the stock quoted at $50, submit a market order, but by the time the data travels through the fiber optic cables and executes a second later,
the price is spiked, and he ends up paying $55.
Which leads us to the alternative, the limit order. This is for when Fred decides to actually be careful for once. He says, Betty, I want to buy this stock, but I will only buy it if the price is $50 or lower, not a single penny more.
That is a buy limit order. A limit order mathematically guarantees the price or better. So Fred is guaranteed he will not pay more than $50.
Right.
But here is the trade-off. It offers absolutely zero guarantee of execution. If the stock is currently trading at $51 and it just keeps going up to $60, $70, $10,
Fred's order will just sit there on the server, completely unfilled, forever.
He misses the trade entirely because he was stubborn about his exact price.
So to summarize for the exam, market order guarantees execution, but not price. Limit order guarantees price, but not execution. That is a foundational concept.
Write that down.
Now let's get into the danger zone. Stop orders and stop limit orders. I call these the safety nets, but sometimes the safety net has a massive hole in it.
Oh, totally. Stop orders are heavily, heavily tested because they involve a two-step mechanical process, and you have to understand the mechanics of both steps. A stop order is initially dormant.
It's asleep.
Right. It doesn't do anything at all until a specific trigger price is hit in the market.
So let's walk through the two steps. Step one, the trigger. The stock trades at or through the specified stop price. Step two, the execution. Once triggered, the order instantly wakes up and becomes a live market order.
Let's do a direct question for the listener using Fumbling Fred to illustrate why this is dangerous.
Yeah.
Let's say Fred bought a stock at $30. It went up to $50.
Wow, good for Fred.
Right. He is thrilled, but he wants to protect his profits while he goes off the grid on a weekend camping trip. So he places a sell stop order at $40. He thinks, if it drops to $40, automatically get me out.
Sounds reasonable.
While he is in the woods, terrible news comes out about the company's accounting practices. The stock plummets. It drops to $40, which triggers his order. Listener, here is the question. Does Fred get exactly $40 for his shares? Pause and really think about the mechanics we just discussed.
We'll give you a beat.
Think about it.
The answer is no, he does not necessarily get $40.
And this is where retail investors get furious and threaten to sue their brokers. When the stock hits $40, the trigger is pulled. His sleeping order wakes up and becomes a live market order to sell.
And remember what we just said about market orders. They guarantee execution, but not price. They execute at the next available price in the market.
So if the market is in an absolute freefall panic, the next available bid might be $35 or even $20. Fred's order is going to execute at whatever someone is willing to pay at that exact second.
His supposed safety net at $40 might actually get him cashed out at $25.
Which is exactly why some investors attempt to use the stop limit order instead. This also has a trigger. But once triggered, instead of becoming a wild, unpredictable market order, it becomes a limit order.
Let's trace the mechanics of that. Fred sets a sell stop limit. He sets the trigger at $40 and the limit at $39. The stock drops to $40. The trigger is pulled. Now, he has a live limit order to sell, but he mathematically refuses to accept less than $39.
And here is the immense danger of the stop limit that you need to understand for the exam. To see this in action, look at the flash crash of 2010 or really any major overnight market gap.
Well, gap downs are brutal.
Let's say that bad accounting news comes out overnight while the market is completely closed. The stock closes on Monday at $45. Tuesday morning, the news breaks and the stock opens at $35. It gapped down violently.
Oh, this is a total disaster for Fred. Let's walk through his order step by step. The stock opened below $40, so his trigger is instantly activated. His order wakes up. It is now a live limit order to sell at $39.
But the stock is currently trading at $35 and dropping fast.
And because his limit order dictates he will not sell for anything less than $39, his order will absolutely not execute.
Never. The stock drops to $30, $20. Fred is still holding the bag, watching his net worth completely evaporate because his limit order prevented the sale.
A stock limit provides price protection, sure, but in a fast-moving, gapping market, it might leave you holding a crashing stock all the way down to zero.
Okay, now for the ultimate exam trap alert regarding orders. It is called the placement matrix. The exam absolutely loves to test where these specific orders are placed relative to the current market price. You simply have to memorize this.
There are mnemonic devices that make this very easy. Let's start with orders placed below the current market price. The acronym is BLSS, pronounced BLISS, buy limits and sell stops.
BLISS. But let's logic through why they are placed below the market, rather than just memorizing letters. A buy limit means you want a bargain. If the stock is currently at $50, you put a buy limit below the market at $45.
You are basically saying, I will only buy if it drops down to my bargain price.
Right. And a sell stop is a safety net to protect a long position. If the stock is at $50, you put a sell stop below the market at $45 to limit your losses if it falls. Both inherently belong below the current price.
Now for the orders placed above the current market price, the acronym is SLBS, pronounced SLOBS, sell limits and buy stops.
SLOBS. Let's logic these out too. A sell limit means you want to sell at a premium. If the stock is at $50, you put a sell limit above the market at $55.
You are saying, I will only sell if someone pays me top dollar.
Exactly. Now, a buy stop is a bit trickier conceptually. It is usually used to protect a short position or to catch a momentum breakout. If the stock is at $50, you might put a buy stop above the market at $55. You are saying, if it breaks through this upward resistance level, it's going to the moon and I want to jump in.
Exactly. BLSS is below the market. SLBS is above the market. If you see an exam question asking which order type would be placed above the current trading price, and your options are buy limit, sell stop, or sell limit.
You use your acronyms. Sell limit is part of SLBS, so it must be placed above the market.
memorize BLSS and SLBS. It is literally free points on the exam. All right, let's transition. Fred is placing all these complex orders. Where is the actual money coming from to fund this chaos? Let's dive into account types and the danger zone. Let's start with the most basic, cash accounts and settlement.
In a cash account, the concept is incredibly simple. You must pay 100% of the purchase price with your own money.
No borrowing.
Absolutely no borrowing from the broker-dealer allowed.
But the timing of that payment is what the exam tests relentlessly. And listener, pay very, very close attention because there is a recent major SEC rule update here that the exam will try to trick you on. What is the standard settlement time for stocks, bonds, ETFs, and options?
It is now T plus one, trade date plus one business day.
T plus one. This is a massive structural shift. For years and years, the standard was T plus two.
Right, people studying old textbooks get destroyed by this.
Yes. The exam might try to trick you by offering T plus two as an option, perhaps in a question framed around an older scenario, but you must know that T plus one is the current standard.
And it really helps to understand why the SEC forced this move to T plus one. It's all about counterparty risk and systemic stability. Think back to the meme stock frenzy of 2021.
Oh, the GameStop craziness.
Exactly. The longer the time between the trade execution and the actual settlement, the physical exchange of cash for the digital certificates at the clearing firm, the higher the risk that one party defaults, goes bankrupt, or simply doesn't have the funds.
Too much time for things to go wrong.
Right. Technology has advanced enough to compress that timeline to a single day, drastically reducing systemic risk in volatile markets.
Okay, so Fred buys a stock on Monday. By Tuesday, T plus one, he has to have the actual cash in his account to pay for it.
He has to.
But let's say Fred thinks he has found an infinite money glitch. This is a classic fumbling Fred move. On Monday morning, he has zero cash in his account. He buys $10,000 worth of stock anyway. By Monday afternoon, the stock jumps to $11,000.
I see where this is going.
Fred immediately sells the stock, locks in the $1,000 profit, and thinks he is an absolute financial genius. He never actually put up the initial $10,000. What just happened?
Fred just committed a major federal violation called free riding. He bought a security and sold it before he ever paid for it. He essentially took a free ride on the broker-dealer's capital without their permission.
And what is the penalty for this brilliant maneuver?
His account will be immediately frozen for 90 days.
90 days.
Now, frozen doesn't mean he can't trade at all, but it means he loses all leeway. He can only trade if he deposits 100% of the cash up front before any trade is ever executed. The exam tests the penalty for free riding frequently. Remember the 90-day freeze.
Now let's talk about the strategy that actually could destroy Fred's life, the one we teased at the very beginning of the deep dive. Short selling. I call this the widowmaker.
It is an incredibly aggressive, highly sophisticated strategy that retail investors often completely misunderstand. In a normal trade, you buy a stock hoping it goes up. In a short sale, fumbling Fred looks at a company, well, let's use his Hypergalactic crypto stock, and decides the company is an absolute fraud.
He thinks it's going to zero.
Right. He thinks the stock is going to crash. So he wants to profit from the decline.
Let's walk through the exact mechanics because they are bizarre if you've never done it. Step one, Fred borrows shares of the stock from broker Betty's firm. He does not own them. He is just renting them.
Step two. He immediately turns around and sells those borrowed shares on the open market to someone else at the current price, say $50 a share. He pockets the $50 cash.
But he still legally owes the broker the actual shares?
Exactly. His master plan is to wait for the stock to drop to, say, $10 a share. Then he will go back into the market, buy the shares for $10, return the borrowed shares to Betty to close his debt, and keep the $40 difference as his profit.
Sell high, buy low, just in reverse order.
That's the theory.
But why is this called the widowmaker? Why does the exam treat short selling with such extreme regulatory caution?
Because of the asymmetrical risk profile. When you buy a stock normally, your risk is mathematically capped. If you buy a stock for $50, the absolute worst thing that can happen is the company goes completely bankrupt and the stock goes to zero.
You lose your $50.
It hurts, but your loss is strictly limited. But when you short a stock,
the loss potential is theoretically infinite.
Infinite. A stock's price can only fall to zero, but there is no ceiling to how high it can rise. Let's look at the GameStop short squeeze as the perfect historical example. Let's say Fred shorts a stock at $50. Instead of crashing like he predicted, a massive wave of retail investors decide to buy it.
And push it up.
The stock rockets to $100, then $500, then $1,000 a share. Fred is legally obligated to buy those shares back on the open market to return them to Betty.
So he sold them for $50, and he might have to buy them back for $1,000 or $5,000.
There is no mathematical ceiling to his ruin.
Which brings us to a huge exam trap alert. Because the risk is so immense and unlimited, short sales absolutely must happen in a margin account. You legally cannot execute a short sale in a cash account.
The exam writers will often present a distractor answer that sounds perfectly logical and prudent if you aren't paying attention. It might say something like, to reduce risk for an aggressive client, an advisor should confine all short sales to cash accounts.
Sounds safe, right.
Sounds safe. Cash accounts are safer. But it is entirely wrong because it is structurally impossible. By definition, short selling involves borrowing assets, and you cannot borrow anything cash or securities in a cash account.
And here's a fun little extra pain point for short sellers that the exam loves. Direct question for the listener. What happens if the company pays a cash dividend while Fred is short the stock?
This is a good one.
Remember, he borrowed the shares from someone else. Let's call him investor Ian. Ian still technically owns the shares. He just lent them out. When the company issues a $1 dividend, who gets the money? Pause and think.
Fumbling Fred, the short seller, has to pay that dividend out of his own pocket to the person he borrowed the shares from.
He owes the dividend to the lender.
Adding literal insult to infinite injury.
Okay, since shorting absolutely requires a margin account, we need to dive deep into margin rules. Margin is simply borrowing money from your broker-dealer to buy securities.
It amplifies your buying power.
Which means it amplifies your gains, but also violently amplifies your losses.
The rules governing margin are strict, layered, and heavily tested. The foundational baseline rule actually comes from the Federal Reserve Board, not the SEC.
Right.
And it's called Regulation T.
Reg T. Let's do some math. Reg T requires a 50% initial margin deposit. Listener, here is your direct question. Fumbling Fred opens a brand new margin account and deposits $10,000 in cash. Assuming he only buys fully marginable stocks, what is his total buying power? How much stock can he legally buy? Take a second.
His total buying power is $20,000.
Yes. If the initial requirement is 50%, that means Fred's cash deposit covers half the purchase and the broker-dealer is legally allowed to lend him the other half. He puts up $10,000, he borrows $10. His total buying power is $20,000.
But the exam loves to test the exceptions and the hard minimums. Here's an exam trap alert. Regulation T has a hard minimum equity requirement of $2,000 to open a margin account.
I want to logic this out. Let's say Fred is mostly broke, but he wants to try trading on margin. He only wants to buy $1,000 worth of stock. If Reg T is 50%, he should only have to deposit $500, right? That's the math.
Mathematically, yes, but legally, no. The $2,000 minimum rule completely supersedes the 50% rule for small accounts. Even if he only wants to buy $1,000 of stock, he must deposit $2,000 to even open the margin account.
Gotcha.
The exam will tell you a scenario with a very small trade and ask for the required deposit. If the trade is small, the answer is usually $2,000.
Okay, so Fred gets his account open, he deposits the $2,000, he buys stock on margin, he's leveraged, but then the stock starts to drop. This introduces FINRA's maintenance margin rule. What is the minimum maintenance equity required by FINRA for a long stock position?
It is 25%. Meaning the actual equity in Fred's account, which is the current market value of the stock minus the amount of money he borrowed from the broker, cannot fall below 25% of the total market value of those securities.
And what happens if the stock tanks, his leverage turns against him, and his equity falls below that 25% threshold?
He gets hit with the dreaded margin call.
This is where the reality of Wall Street gets brutal. Fred gets a notification on his phone. He has fallen below maintenance margin. He is legally required to immediately deposit more cash or more fully paid securities to bring his equity back up to the minimum.
All right.
But fumbling Fred being Fred, he ignores the alert. He assumes the market will bounce back. He goes golfing. What happens next?
Broker Betty's clearing firm takes immediate action, and they do not need to ask nicely. If the margin call is not met promptly, the broker dealer has the absolute legal right to liquidate the assets in Fred's account to cover the shortfall and protect themselves.
And here's the most painful part, which the exam explicitly tests. Does Fred get to choose which stocks the broker sells? Like, can he call them up and say, please just sell my boring municipal bonds, but whatever you do, do not touch my favorite tech stock?
No. He has absolutely zero say in the matter. The broker dealer will liquidate whatever they need to in whatever order they choose without his consent to protect the firm's capital from losses.
Wow.
They dictate the terms entirely. The firm will protect itself first, Always.
It is ruthless, but it is the contractual reality of margin trading.
Okay.
We are entering the final major section, the ultimate obligation. Fred is out there trading on margin, putting in crazy limit orders, trying to short stocks, paying markups. With all this chaos, what legal obligation does a broker Betty have to ensure Fred is getting a fair shake on his trades?
This brings us to the best execution standard. Under FINRA rules, broker-dealers are required to use reasonable diligence to find the best market for a security and execute the trade at the most favorable price for the customer under current market conditions.
Let me push back hard on that exact phrasing, most favorable price. Wait, so Betty legally guarantees that Fred gets the absolute, mathematical, undeniable best price in the entire universe on every single trade. If he gets a penny less than the absolute best, can he sue her?
Excellent pushback. And this is a massive exam trap alert. The answer is an emphatic no. Best execution does not mean the absolute best price every single time. It means the firm used reasonable diligence under the circumstances.
Reasonable diligence. The classic legal loophole phrase. What does that actually mean in the real world?
It means they have to look at a holistic matrix of factors. Price is obviously the biggest and most important one. But they also have to consider the speed of execution.
Because speed matters.
Right. If Fred submits a market order in a violently crashing market, getting the trade executed in milliseconds might be far more important to him than squeezing out an extra microscopic fraction of a penny on price.
True.
They have to consider the size of the order. Trying to unload a block of 1 million shares is very different than selling 10 shares. They have to consider the transaction costs and the overall likelihood that the order will actually execute at a given venue.
It's a holistic review. And here's a key point. Betty's firm cannot just pass the buck. A firm cannot delegate its best execution obligation to another broker-dealer.
No, they can't.
They can route the order somewhere else for execution, but Betty's firm is ultimately legally responsible for ensuring reasonable diligence was applied. They have to conduct regular, rigorous, documented reviews of their execution quality.
Now, if we're talking about routing orders to different venues, we absolutely have to talk about the elephant in the room. Payment for order flow. Or PFOF.
PFOF, the ultimate Wall Street controversy. Let's break down the mechanics of this. Broker Betty has all these orders coming in from fumbling Fred and thousands of other retail investors. She needs to send them somewhere to be executed.
Right.
Market maker Mike desperately wants those orders. He wants the flow because he makes his money on the bid-ask spread, and more volume means more spread profit for him.
Exactly.
So Mike goes to Betty and says, hey, if you route all your retail orders to me instead of the exchange, I will pay you a fraction of a cent for every single share you send my way.
That is payment for order flow. The market maker is literally paying the broker dealer for the privilege of executing their customer orders.
But wait, let me logic this out. That sounds like a massive inherent conflict of interest. If Mike is paying Betty and another market maker isn't Betty just going to route all the orders to Mike to collect the cash, even if Mike isn't giving Fred the best execution price?
It absolutely is a conflict of interest. The SEC and FINRA openly acknowledge that. But here is the critical rule you must know for the exam. Payment for order flow is perfectly legal.
It's legal, but with massive strings attached, right?
Heavy, heavy strings. It must be strictly and publicly disclosed. Broker-dealers are required to publish quarterly public reports, known as 606 reports, detailing exactly where they routed their customer orders and exactly what kind of financial PFOF arrangements they have with those venues.
So everyone can see it.
Right. They have to shine a massive regulatory spotlight on the conflict.
And here is the exam trap alert on this exact topic. The exam will ask how PFOF interacts with the best execution obligation we just talked about. Does receiving payment for order flow automatically mean Betty is violating her best execution duty?
No, it does not automatically violate best execution. A firm can accept PFOF, but they must still satisfy their duty of reasonable diligence to get the customer the most favorable price.
They can't let the money blind them.
Exactly. They cannot let the payment interfere with the execution quality. If Mike pays Betty a ton of money, but Mike's prices are terrible for Fred, Betty has to stop routing to Mike or she violates best execution. The duty to the client always supersedes the payment from the market maker.
And just to be perfectly clear, because the exam will try to trick you with the wording, who is actually paying for the order flow? Is Fred paying Betty an extra hidden fee?
No. PFOF is paid by the market maker, Mike, directly to the broker-dealer, Betty. It is a back-end institutional transaction. The retail investor does not pay PFOF directly.
Wow. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We have mapped out the entire plumbing system of a trade from the app UI to the clearing firm vault. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most heavily tested gotchas from this deep dive. Listener, lock these in right now.
Ready. If a firm's compensation is a commission, what capacity are they acting in?
Agency. They are a broker. Matchmaker.
If a firm's compensation is a markup or markdown, what capacity?
Principal. They are a dealer. Trading from inventory.
What type of account is absolutely legally required to execute a short sale?
A margin account. No exceptions whatsoever.
Which order type mathematically guarantees execution but provides zero guarantee on price?
A market order.
Which order type mathematically guarantees price but provides zero guarantee of execution?
A limit order.
And what is the standard, newly updated settlement time frame for stocks and bonds today?
T+1. Trade date plus one business day.
Excellent. If you have those specific concepts burned into your memory, you're going to be in fantastic shape for this section.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought to chew on. We talked a lot about the bid-ask spread and commissions, but think about how technology has fundamentally changed this landscape over the last decade. It has compressed the bid-ask spread on major stocks down to pennies, or even fractions of a penny, and major brokerages have essentially slashed front-end commissions to zero. Trading is practically free on the surface.
Which means the real battleground for Wall Street's profits has shifted entirely to the shadows.
Exactly. If they aren't making money on massive commissions or wide spreads anymore, how are these billion-dollar firms surviving? They are surviving on payment for order flow. They are surviving on the implicit microscopic costs hidden in execution speed. They were surviving by lending out fully paid securities to short sellers. You aren't just learning arbitrary rules for a multiple choice test here. You are learning the actual plumbing of the global financial machine. You are learning how the casino actually makes its money when the drinks are free.
It is a fascinating ecosystem once you look past the regulatory jargon and see the mechanics underneath.
It really is. Remember, use your flashcards, review your notes, and when you see a question about fumbling Fred trying to short a stock in a cash account, you'll know exactly why he can't. Approach this exam with confidence. You've got this. Good luck.